Really glad that you are here. I want to begin because today is going to be really significant. And it's going to be a challenge. There's some things that might be said that you won't like and might make you mad. And so today, maybe as much as we need God's grace every Sunday, today we're really going to need it. And so let's pray together and we will ask that God have his way with our hearts today, okay? Lord, thank you so much that you love us in spite of who we are, in spite of the way we act, in spite of our attitudes that we hold and that we demonstrate. You love us to the core of who we are, Lord, and certainly we do not deserve that. We love you so much. And as we come to our topic today of racism, we're mindful of all that is going on in our country. We're mindful of the rhetoric. We're mindful of the anger on both sides and all sides. We're mindful, Lord, that we are a broken people. The sin nature manifests itself in so many different ways in our lives and in other people's lives. And Lord, it feels like we're in one of these watershed moments for our country. Sometimes I don't know what to pray. I don't know what is right. I don't know what to do and how to think and how to process and what to believe. But Lord, I believe in you and I trust you. And we want to follow what you have for us. So today, Lord, give us grace as we listen to our friend Luther talk about racism from a perspective that most of us as white people won't understand. We might feel like he's just telling some of his stories, but that doesn't really happen around here, or that's not the normative expression. But Lord, could it be that we are insulated here in a way that other people are not? So Lord, help us to think outside of ourselves today for your glory. Lord, as we walk away, it is my desire that we confront some of the long-held beliefs that we have that are dishonoring to you. Help us to see them clearly in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, in my heart over these last weeks, since George Floyd's death, probably a lot like you, I have felt very conflicted. I haven't known exactly what to feel. On one side, I feel like if you don't break the law, you have nothing to fear from police. That's on one side. But then on the other side, I feel this tension within myself with some deep-held and long-standing categories of racism that I have within me. And so I have felt conflicted, and probably you have as well. Now, the Bible is very clear that man's heart is exceedingly wicked, exceedingly deceitful, which means that none of us like to self-reflect and wonder if the beliefs that we hold are right. We don't like to do that. It's uncomfortable. It makes us squeamish. And it's far easier to hold on to our nice, easy categories. It's far easier to do that than it is to really confront what we might hold deep within ourselves. The truth of the matter is that most of us, I think, we would say, I'm not a racist. I'm not a racist. And I bet if we went around and we handed the mic, nobody would stand up and go, you know, I am a racist. We all believe, I think, for the most part, that we are not racist. But most of us would say, and I think most of us would say, we have black friends and Latin friends, and we have Asian friends, and maybe even a really good Jordanian friend sitting in the back row, and we love these people. And I would say that we would all say we don't see them through the lens of their ethnicity or their race. We don't see them that way. We just see them as people we love. And so we would conclude that we are not racist. But I think in this moment right now in our country, it would be and it will be very good for us to try to walk a little bit in the shoes of somebody that looks different, thinks different, and talks differently than we do. And to, I think, walk down that road of self-discovery perhaps just a little bit. And I think if we are open enough, Luther's words today might shine some light into some dark corners of assumptions that we hold. And if we see those dark corners clearly, we may not like what we see. So fair warning today, as we try to, what Daniel said this week, right? We're going to try to move the needle. We want to move the needle for us as a group, for us as a bunch, mostly white, middle class, rural people who don't have to confront things like Luther does in Kansas City. We're going to try to move the needle, but let's just set the baseline. The Bible is very clear, Genesis 1:26, 1:27. All human beings are made in the image of God. All human beings are valuable, equally valuable. No one is more valuable, no one is less valuable. We would all say that, right? And we believe that, right? And that sets the baseline for us. So to disparage a certain group because of the melanin they have in their skin that makes them lighter or darker, we would all say that is crazy. We wouldn't want to do that as followers of Jesus Christ, as followers who say, no, all men are created in the image of God and are inherently valuable. And yet, it is something that is very easy for us to do. Jesus, of course, at the end of his life, he prayed that his disciples would be one. Romans 15 calls for racial unity within the church, that the church would be united, that we would be unified far beyond race bounds, because now we are all part of one family, the family of God. So Thursday of this week, Danielle and I went down to Kansas City, and we spent time with Luther Eatman, who is a black man. He is a pastor. Many of you know who he is because he has preached in this church many times. Many of you know him. Many of you love him. And I think many of you consider him to be your friend. And Luther has one of these infectious personalities where he makes everyone feel like they're his best friend. He's just great. He's almost hypnotic that way. So what I did this last week, for those that submitted questions for Luther, I took those questions and kind of massaged them around a little bit into 9 main questions to ask Luther. Now, if you know Luther, he can't do anything short. So it's a little bit long. We're not going to get out on time. And the rest of our time, we're going to watch this video of me asking your questions to him. And some of them are a little bit in your face. We're going to stop a few times along the way with a few commentaries and then conclude at the end. But I implore you to try your very best to open your mind, open your heart, self-reflect a little bit on some of his answers. Because I'm telling you, some of the things he's going to say, you're going to say, I don't know if I can buy that. He's going to say some things about what it's like to be rural and white. He's going to say some things about police. And I want you to listen, to evaluate, to open your minds and hearts, because this is a good moment for us as God's people to move the needle a little bit, to understand what it's like to be someone different, to look differently, to think differently, to walk a mile in the shoes of someone different. And could it be that today God is going to move our hearts in a way that perhaps he hasn't in a long time in this specific category of race? So let's listen to what Luther has to say. Let's roll the video, and again, we'll stop a few times for some commentary. Well, good morning, Luther. Thanks a lot for spending some time talking about this issue that right now in our country is the issue that people are talking about. It's on the news, it's in newspapers, commentators, editorials. Everybody is talking about right now racism. So thank you so much for spending some time with us, and we'll jump right on in. And the first question that I have for you is, how would you define racism? And do you think that it still exists in America today? And if so, who is most affected by it?
Well, I just love you with them compound sentences and those questions. First of all, I appreciate the opportunity, man. You know, I really want to speak my heart on this. really God's heart, and I don't want to come from a fleshly point of view. So when we talk about racism, I want to be able to eliminate the stigma of racism right quickly, because first of all, there's only one race. That's the human race. The term racism basically comes from a construct of human beings. So the aspect of what some people would define racism is one group of people feeling superior over another and establishing a system to make sure that that maintains. So that's basically the main concept of racism. We can see it in the Bible narratives where the Jews thought they were way superior than the Gentiles or even the Sumerians. And so they had this, created this system of separation. So is it still in existence today? Yes, it is. It's the nature of the human being. And it is this aspect of what God has a system that is opposite of man. Jesus says this, is that the first will be last and the last will be first. Everybody wants to be first.
Everybody wants to
be first. Everybody wants to be first. And you can see from the time of human history all the way back, all the way up to the contemporary times, there's always been one group of people enslaving another. So this is nothing new. What's the other question?
Who's the most affected by it?
I think
in today,
especially in this country, the minorities in this context is African Americans that is taking the stage at this point, but it's affecting all minorities based on the fact that the Caucasian people in this world are the majority here, and we know that they're the majority, but they're also the ones that designs the system. They create the laws, they create the bills, and so that power structure is still in existence. So I think it affects all the minorities.
Okay. So in America, then, the minorities would be Latins, Jews.
Mm-hmm.
What? We had this conversation a little bit. Native Americans.
Yes.
Many of them are on reservations.
Yes.
And certainly they feel the stigma there.
Yes.
Asians,
yes.
Certainly, especially World War II and the gathering together of Japanese into concentration camps. Certainly with all that's been going on in the Middle East, those that are of Middle East descent here have felt it. So it has multiple levels.
Yes.
The conversation right now in America is mostly the white and black and the racism that exists there.
Mm-hmm.
So many of these questions, all these questions have been submitted by people in our church, and many of them love you. And Lenita to death. But one of the really good questions that was submitted is the question, have you ever had an interaction with police that would surprise us? Or one that maybe really defined how you...
Certainly it could be applied to lots of other categories, even beyond race. So let's be clear on how this goes. All people are equally valuable to God. And in this area of racism, to treat anybody as inferior to you for any reason, to see them, to process them, to talk to them, to talk down to them for any reason, that is exercising this inferior and superior, what Luther would say is racism. He's going to come back to the stereotyping that we do to other people that are different than us. But can we not all agree that treating yourself as superior to somebody else is categorically wrong? Can we all agree on that? All right, let's keep going with the video.
So many of these questions, all these questions have been submitted by people in our church, and many of them love you. And Lenita to death. But one of the really good questions that was submitted is the question, have you ever had an interaction with police that would surprise us? Or one that maybe really defined how you understand that interaction. Now, understanding that you came to know Jesus a little later in life, and certainly the interactions that you had with police before then are significantly different than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
But what would be maybe a story that would surprise people in Nebraska to hear, not just that it happened to you, but that it happens ever?
Well, one of the things is this, is that I was basically at night is basically during that time in the 60s and 70s, especially late 70s when I was on the streets, at night you always stereotype like you're going to be doing something wrong. I had two police cars. I'm walking, and one car just jumps over the curb in front of me, and the other one behind me. And I'm wondering why. And it's because they saw me going from one house and going back to that house maybe two or three times. And they assumed that I was doing drugs. They assumed that I was selling drugs. And basically, they handcuffed me. They slammed me. And, of course, they weren't speaking very nicely to me.
Yeah.
So it was just in that case. I had no pistol. I had no guns. I had no weapons on me whatsoever. I was basically heading on to another place. And that just really, I wasn't high or anything at the time. But it created some fear for me. I didn't know if I was going to make it out of there or not. You know, I really didn't. But eventually they got a call, and then they left me alone and went about their business. Well, that shook me. You know, growing up in my mom and dad from the South, and seeing my grandfather being cut up based on the aspect of racism, and my dad has to bring him home. And then also, too, being able to not go into certain places and being able not to drink out of certain water fountains and people calling you the N-word on a regular basis and coons and things of this nature. These are things that you learn to adapt to, but not to accept. One significant time I was in a place, I was on the streets, I was in a drug house, but I was not selling drugs, and at that point I was not doing drugs, and the house got invaded by the police. And so they tied me up with the with the zip ties, and I was tied up. They searched me and didn't find anything. So they didn't find anything in the house. Ironically, they didn't find anything in the house. And so this white police officer came back to me. He said, I'm going to search you again. I said, for what? You already searched me. He had a bag of dope in his hand. I'm watching him. Fortunately, there was a black detective standing there watching him too, and he dropped the bag. He said, oh, look what I found. And if the black police officer was not standing there, I would have been accused of selling drugs. I'd have been accused of a crime that I didn't commit, because he was trying to plant some drugs on me, because he wanted to bust somebody. Mm-hmm. And that was very significant. I still see this detective from time to time, and every time I see him, I get kind of emotional. I said, because you saved me from the penitentiary. Mm-hmm. You know, God used that man to save me from the penitentiary. But that was something like the norm for me. Even when I was going to Minden, Nebraska one time, and I was going to go speak on this very subject, racial reconciliation, with the youth group in Minden, right? So I get on I-80, and all you guys been on I-80. It's 75, right? It's a rental car, right? And it's basically new, only got 5,000 miles on it. So I put on cruise control. As I got on 80, I saw four state troopers. And I just happened to look over there at them, and I kept going forward. But that's when the Spirit of God told me, said, you're going to get pulled over. So be prepared. So mentally and spiritually, I was getting prepared to get pulled over. A lot of cars were passing me, because like I said, I was doing 75. He pulled me over, and he asked me this question. He said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to Minden, Nebraska. Now, mind you, there's not a lot of people my color in Minden, Nebraska. So he said, what business do you have there? And he did not see the books that were sitting in my passenger seat, because I have my Bible and I have some other books there. And I told him, and I looked him dead in his eye. Well, first of all, he told me, he said, you know you were speeding. I said, I can't be speeding unless this cruise control is broken. I was doing 75, and there was other cars passing me. And he said, well, you can get out the car and find. I said, no, I don't need to get out the car. He said, well, where are you going? I said, I'm going to Minden. What business? I said, I'm going to go teach this youth group on racial reconciliation. His whole face turned red, because now he's looking in my car. He sees my Bible. He sees my books on racial reconciliation. And he says, okay, I'll be right back. At that time, I knew he has to try to scramble and try to fix this.
Mm-hmm.
Because he knew he made a terrible mistake. He's stereotyping me. So when I, long story short, when I get to Minden, because I was late, They said, man, what happened? I said, guess what? You're never going to believe this. What? I got stopped by the state troopers. They stereotyped me. They said, what did you tell them? I said, I was coming to Menin to talk about racial reconciliation. So that was, I mean, this is something that is not new. It happens to the best of us. But one of the things that we try to teach our kids is this. is to, and we have to be better at this with our kids, because some of my kids are very upset that they heard too many horror stories, that you want to be on your best behavior when you deal with a cop, especially a white officer and you being black, because there's this heightened sense that, based on what we see, that our kids may not make it home. And mothers and fathers, they train us to speak, make sure our hands are visible, make sure that we say yes, sir, no, sir, look them in the eye, don't look away, but always be respectful, and then just follow their commands. Mm-hmm. And that's basically, you know, one of the things for me, I don't fear people, so I'm going to be who I am, but I always speak with people in real respect, and I think that if we do that, we'd be fine. So those are just some of the things, man. That incident in that drug house, I really could have been gone and you guys wouldn't even know me. I think that was a turning point in my life.
So it's interesting, in the two stories you told, the first one would have been before you knew Christ, mm-hmm. BC days. The other one, obviously, years later, but still a similar type situation.
And I wasn't, you know, during that period of time, I had no fear because I had no guilt in what I was doing. The other time, I had guilt because even though I wasn't doing things at the time, I was still not living a life that was conducive to glorify God. But even that didn't matter. It's just the way. I remember I got shot not too far from here on 13th and Wood. I got shot with a sawed-off from the waist down by some guys that were young and they were on drugs. So when the police came, I can't move. And I'm bleeding, and my arms are out like this, and the police officer's foot, his shoe was right by my hand, and he kicked my hand as though I am a predator or something. I'm down here bleeding. He's kicking me, you know? And I didn't understand that at all, you know? In my mind, I said, dang, I probably need some protection from this guy, you know? Because I'm down on 13th and Wood. They stereotype. They assume that we all gangbangers, that we all doing something wrong. But I'm the one that got shot, you know. And he just kicked me for no reason whatsoever. None.
So if I were to ask the people in your church, how often, thinking like on a regular basis, how often do you feel, and you've given some examples of the police, but certainly the systemic racism, which is a big talking point right mm-hmm. now, the broader sense culturally of racism, how often do they feel this, I'm being discriminated against because I am black? How often, say, daily, weekly, monthly, and who do they feel it from? Who's making them feel that way?
Well, if you go into the department store, in which this is something that happens on a daily basis for a lot of African Americans, especially some people in our, because it's happened to me. If you go into a white-owned establishment, when you walk in, first thing they're going to do is address you. How you doing? What do you need? They won't say that to a Caucasian person. The Caucasian person can go and do whatever they want. When we're coming in, first thing they want to do is, what do you want? What do you need? And then I said, I'm just coming to the shop. I'm just taking a look. They said, okay. But they're watching us every step of the way. And they're following us. And so even in that sense, I remember being in New Orleans, and I was, because I was down there doing some church planning work, and I was staying with this white couple, Mark Lewis and she kidding me. I'm on video too. Lord Jesus. I'm sorry. I forgot your name, but anyway.
But you mean a lot to me.
Love you so much. So we're going to the store, right? And people wouldn't follow her, but they were following me. And I said, can I help you? And he said, no, nothing. So they kept following me. I kept asking, can I help you? And it dawned on me right there. I said, these people are following me in this store thinking I'm going to steal something. You know? And if you can get these common things, I think that it's just, it's something that is, it's not everywhere. It's just in certain places that you can go in this city. And if, especially in suburbia, if they know you don't live out there, they're going to ask you why you're out there. Even though I may be going to visit somebody that I know, why you're out there. And those are just some of the things that this is, happens on a regular basis.
So let me just ask the, I'm trying to think of questions that rural American Christians might think.
Okay.
So is that racism or is that prudence?
No,
for that store owner who's now had, let's say, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years experience, and who he has seen stealing from him. So let's theorize that it's 60, 40, 75, 25, whatever. And he has the history then of being robbed by more African-Americans than Caucasian. So his prudence level radar is up more towards those that, in his experience, have been the perpetrators. So is it racism or is it prudence?
That's stereotyping. Because you're putting me in a group of people just because of the color of my skin. That's my natural tendency. That's our natural tendency. So you putting all African-Americans in that group that are minority people, a group of people that have done, but yet because I look like them, my skin color looks like them, you're just assuming that's my nature, that's what I normally do. That's stereotyping. I don't care what you call it, prudence, whatever you want to call it to make you feel good, but that is stereotyping.
Okay, so if you were that store owner, what would you have done differently?
Of course, you can always be observant for your stuff, but I'll let them have the freedom, because one of the things that we do here is this. There's some people who don't like what we do, and so they will leave hostile. And so one of the things I tell people here, you don't know what God is going to do with a person's life. So when that person comes out, we want to embrace them like they spanking brand new. We don't want to use people's past against them, because nobody wants to be analyzed or defined by their past, and that like that past can't be changed, because that's saying to me as a Christian that God can't change me. And so everybody who comes back here, because we deal with a lot of homeless people, people on drugs, so they come and go, but we always going to treat them as though they're brand new. Because I never want to define, because that's one of the things that causes a lot of people in our community, because they're being defined by their past, and God has changed them, and people still see them in that way.
Yeah. Okay.
That's unjust.
So So for me, this was a really significant question, and it was significant because I think our experiences define our reality. So if we've had these experiences, whether face-to-face or stories we've heard or people that we know have had these experiences, it's going to affect how we respond in these kinds of situations. So the question was that, with the store owner, was that prudent or was that prejudice? For me, that was a really significant question. But I think there's some lines about systemic racism that hinge right there on Luther's answer. Do we treat each person as brand new, or do we lump them in with other experiences that we've had with people similar to them? And I know that I am a lumper. I lump people in. And I see somebody and I draw certain conclusions, and by no means am I very good at treating everybody as brand new, as clean slate, without projecting some of my experiences and notions on them and expecting them to act a certain way or to talk a certain way or to do a certain thing. And this was actually one of the subjects that Luther and I talked about a lot over 2 days. And I argued with him, and he argued with me back in a great-hearted way. But he kept coming back to that idea. Do you treat everyone as fresh slate or not? And every time he said it, I could feel the hammer crushing against my nice little shell, my safe zone, you know. And I don't think I do that very well. I think I'm very quick to push people into categories. His words challenged me. Maybe they challenge you as well. Let's keep going.
I think that's well stated, and it's fair. So let's change direction just a little bit. We talked last night how your grandfather, you're from the South.
Mm-hmm.
So your grandfather.
And great-grandfather.
Your great-grandfather was white. I wasn't going there, but that's also true. Yeah. So your grandfather, mm-hmm, and your father, mm-hmm, fought against, in the South,
mm-hmm,
racism in a way that's maybe similar but very different than racism today.
Oh, yeah.
So how have you seen a change in racial tensions throughout your lifetime? And what still needs to take place as we continue to march forward and work in this area?
I think that there has been some change. I think that during those period of time, there was this aspect of segregation. I mean, the Jim Crow laws that was in the place where white and black could not mix. They could not be in the same place. If a black man was to offer a white lady a lighter of her cigarette, well, that was called inappropriate. That was an inappropriate action, and that person could be in jail for that. And so that has, and based in 1964, when it came to this, the Civil Rights Movement and this act that was in place, that what we're able to be in certain places now based on law, but law don't change people's hearts. So you have people who engage, you know, and then you have kids now who interact more. I think in this time and era, we have ethnicities that are growing up together. They're loving one another. They're encouraging one another. They're learning from one another. Back then, that was not it. The case back then was that superiority, inferiority, and that's how it was supposed to be. But now it's a different sense. But yet and still, there will always be this passed down from one generation to another in certain families. We are above them. Mm-hmm. And it's based on what some people say race, but it's based on color. It's based on ethnicity. It's based on economics. It's based on value. It's based on power. And it's based on those types of situations. Haven't gotten better? I believe it has. I mean, you're not sitting here. You know, your wife is sitting right there. I can hug your wife and you won't do anything. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, we're being cordial one another. Mm-hmm. We're friends. I mean, we can develop a relationship. Back then, that couldn't happen. You know, I think even the churches now are beginning, because in the 60s, there's this, and it's still down south a lot, black liberation theology, which basically means there's a lot of black churches who do not associate with white churches. And it's based on the aspect of the power struggle. Give us power, then we will then interact. But that's the nature, and that's the basis of it. We have the Nation of Islam. Nation of Islam is a entity supposed to be spiritual, but yet its main issue is to be divisive. It is to have whites on this side, blacks on this side, and then we can do business together, but never mingle together. They have a very negative view of white people, and so the aspect in that is that we look at our nature, and our nature tends to imitate the very things that we hate.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that things have gotten better. I think what can move it forward is that we continue to act like, don't act like it doesn't exist. It still exists, and we still have the dialogue. I'm dealing with racism. I'm dealing with injustices in our community every day. Housing, unemployment, drugs, single parenting, abortion. We're dealing with prostitution. We're dealing with all these types of issues. And one of the things is this, in this area that we're in Northeast area, it's being neglected. But I think there's some change that's going to take place.
Yeah. Because certainly nowhere in America are we going to see whites only, blacks only bathrooms, drinking fountains, no. restaurants, or anything that in the 60s was still going on.
Yeah, that I don't think. You have to be real bold to try to get that one off. I was just looking at the news today, and there was the statue of in Virginia of Arthur Ashe, right? Mm-hmm. African American, right? And one of the things that are happening right now, they're taking down Confederate flags right. and statues Correct. And things of this nature. So they defaced his and put White Lives Matter, and then Black Lives Matter cohorts coming. They put in red, Black Lives Matter. It's for me, it's the tit for tat, and that right there would never solve anything at mm-hmm. all. I'm not a fan of violence. I do not condone the rioting. I think protest is good, and I think one of the things that has happened, people have put the peaceful protesters in with the rioters, and that's a false judgment, because one of the things is this. Jesus is going to come back, and there's going to be the wheat and the tares. All right, they look the same, but they're not the same.
Yeah.
We look at the 10 bridesmaids. 5 had all, and 5 didn't. And so, but they look the same. Right. And I think that we have to have spiritual discernment, because if not, if we continue to be led by our nature, we would never solve this problem. As a matter of fact, I don't believe it will be solved. I believe that it can be curbed a little bit. Mm-hmm. Especially in the church. I don't expect it in the world.
Yeah.
But I expect it in the church.
So for those that haven't read your newsletter then, what is your relationship to Black Lives Matter? What is your understanding of what they want, what they're demanding? And why does it sometimes feel like only certain Black Lives Matter? Like if you... The question of aborted babies, mm-hmm. aborted black babies, that we're not going to talk about that. They don't want to talk about that. They want to talk about certain ones. So for those that haven't read your newsletter, as you've tried to explain that, again, what's your relationship to Black Lives Matter? Christian response there. Mm-hmm. What is it they really want? Mm-hmm. And is it a double standard to say that some Black Lives Matter and others do not?
Well, the first aspect, I deal with Black Lives Matter from an all-white from an All Lives Matter perspective.
Okay.
Because that was the initial intent when it first came out. It's the aspect that here I am, I'm an African American, but I keep seeing African Americans being killed by either police, white police officers, or by white civilians and things of this, and I continue to see that. So I asked the question to myself, do Black Lives Matter? We know all lives matter, but it seems like the Black Lives Matter lives don't matter. But for me, from a biblical point of view, yes, they matter. And it should matter to the church. Mm-hmm. Why? Because God created everybody in his image. And the aspect, I've had people call me who are white, my white pastor friends, and they would say, man, how you doing? And I would just ask them, how you doing? Did you see it? Did you think that was just unfair? They said, no. I said, I feel the same way you did. So am I on board with the political aspect of Black Lives Matter? No, I'm not. No, I am not. I am not going down that rabbit hole because that deals with emotions and feelings. That deals with giving evil to evil, and that's not God. And it has become more a political statement than anything else, and I'm not dealing with anything in the political aspect. So, no, we're not identified with that. I put Black Lives Matter in the vernacular that all lives matter, but it seems to me when I see this, it seems like those black lives are not mattering. And so that I think that we all need to focus on that. The second thing is, what is the second question now?
Is it a double standard for some? Well, I asked you, what is it you think Black Lives Matter really wants? Why is there a double standard?
I think in the initial aspect, it just wanted equality. But as we go further down the line, it's taken over by emotions. It's taken over by feeling. I think it's also has turned demonic. Because when people's emotions are unstable, they react and they don't process. And so what you're seeing now is hate. You know, and it's turned into a political agenda where people are identifying with the Democrats or whatever their political agenda is. So I think the initial aspect is just equality. I think that was the initial. But as non-Christians, it will turn into something ugly. The aspect of when people say, when it seems like they don't care about anything else. Here's the thing. What happened in Minneapolis was public. People can come down the street. They saw this happening. They got their phones out, and they videotaped it, right? And this thing right here, God has used to send it around the world. Black people didn't send it around the world. I think God sent it around, and everybody looks at it in a negative way. If you're not in the black community, you don't know what the black community's values are. You're assuming, because we tend to deal with all kinds of issues that suburbia doesn't deal with, that the rural doesn't deal with. We deal with abortion down here. There are no abortion clinics in our community, because we would be right there, you know. We deal with the aspect on black-on-black crime. We see this. We're part of that. We want to try to curb that. We have faith believers here. I mean, pastors. We have marched here, but it's not being advertised, okay? We deal with the aspect of unemployment. We deal with the unjust aspect of the slumlords when it comes to apartments and housing. It is pathetic around here. And so we're dealing with all this, but it's not being publicized. If you were to come and sit with me and not assume, and that's why I like the word it seems, because it seems, the word seems or appears, you're not definite because now you're guessing and assuming. But if you come in and you sit and you talk with the people, then you'd be able to get a different perspective. I think a lot of times people are seeing from the outside, trying to look in and trying to find what they're seeing without understanding the context of what they're seeing.
That leads perfectly to the next question.
Black Lives Matter. And at one point he said, "Why do you think you can tell me what we mean?" I was like, fair point. So we talked a lot about this. So let me clarify, and he's going to come back to it a second time in a few minutes, but he believes that Black Lives Matter at its inception was a fight for all lives to matter. But what they saw over time is that clear evidence that it was just not true. So at its inception, he believes Black Lives Matter was trying to raise the black man, black woman, black race to equality with all lives matter. And I think that it's certainly not my perception that that's true. In fact, I asked him at one point, I said, you know, the phrase Black Lives Matter is kind of offensive, as if you're saying that some should matter more than other lives. And he said, "You've missed the whole point, Scott. You missed the whole point. It's that all lives matter. And we want all lives to equally matter." And that's really something that we as a church and we as believers should get behind. Now, how it's been changed politically and what it's become and all of that, notwithstanding, at its inception, he believes Black Lives Matter was a fight for all lives to matter the same in a world where it was evident that some lives mattered more. So let's keep going on with the video.
That George Floyd's death had anything to do with his race. Reports show that he was on drugs, involved in a criminal act. If he were a white man, do you think the same result would have happened? Or if it had been a black police officer to George Floyd, would we have seen the same kind of riots? Yes or no, why do we assume that it was race-based?
Based on the fact of what we've been seeing. This is not the first time we saw this. And because in the African-American community, we've been seeing this all the time. And that's why we take a look at that and we see how it's treated. So also, let's take a look at some of the situations that happened when white people were involved, like the shootings in our high schools. They were treated like that. But here's a man who allegedly passed a $20 counterfeit bill. He didn't kill anybody, he didn't rob anybody, but yet he was treated as though he didn't matter. And yet we see all these others. I just saw a video not too long ago, about 3 or 4 days, and I talked about this yesterday with you, of a white man assaulting a police officer. And the police officer's running away. And he gets in his car, goes down the block, turns back around, and runs into the police officer's car. She had a gun, but didn't use it.
She was afraid to, I'm sure.
Here's the thing. Guess who was videotaping that? Black people. And they said, and they're commentating, if that had been a black person, he would have been shot. And so when we look at this, it's not the assumption that we believe that. This is what we've been seeing. If this would have been a first-time thing we would have looked at, we wouldn't have liked it. But we have something that we have precedent of what took place. And some people say, how come it couldn't just be a bad cop and a bad person? Because you're now trying to eliminate the diversity that God created. There's animosity in this world, and you're trying to eliminate a problem and not try to see the problem. There is division in our world. And it's based on the aspect of ethnicity. Let's just be real with this. And it's a real thing. And we can't continue to put our head in the sand and turn a blind eye to it. We have to address it. You know, for me, let me just tell you this. When I was growing up, I was 6 or 7 years old. And I told you this, I was on the front porch. And in our area, I grew up, it was 99.9% black. Only one white person. I told you, there was Clifford. Clifford Webb, that's my boy. But this white guy was walking up the street. I don't know where he came from or how he got that far in the middle of an African-American community. This was about 63, 64, all right? And that was real high. They just didn't do that. I saw him, and in my mind, I said, Lord, somebody's going, if they see him, they're going to try to kill this guy. And as I'm thinking these thoughts, they're coming out the house. My dad, who stood about 6'3", 250 pounds, his arms a little bit bigger than mine, went out, threw those guys off him, and covered him with his body. And he told them, this man has done nothing. Leave him alone. I'm 6, 7 years old. I'm watching that. God changed my heart. I want to do that. I want to protect people. I want to see people come together. And my dad, God gave me an example through my dad. That's why I have no animosity toward people or ethnicity. I love ethnicity. I love people. You know, it's just the aspect that we have to call out justice. That's what God has called for the church to do. Light is supposed to expose what's going on in the dark, and we have to call it out. John the Baptist did it, Jesus did it, Paul did it, the church has to do it, and we can't be silent on that. But we have to be able to make sure that we're not being led by our emotions, but by the Spirit. And we have to be just as well when we're accusing people of being unjust.
So down that same path then, why do some black people take offense at All Lives Matter? And we talked about this briefly already. But I think there's many of us that are white that would look at even the phrase Black Lives Matter as offensive in the sense of, why do you think your lives matter more than other lives? Shouldn't it be all lives matter? And if it should be that, why does it seem like some black people take offense at All Lives Matter instead of embracing the idea that, you know, we're all equal in the equality mm-hmm. of all people. Why is that offensive?
It's offensive because you didn't understand why they say Black Lives Matter. Everybody knows that all lives matter. Mm-hmm. And nobody has said that Black lives matter more important than white lives or Hispanic lives. Nobody said that. Mm-hmm. The reason why we said is what I initially said before, is that we do know from this premise that all lives matter. We know that. But when I see black people being killed by white people, the question comes up, why is it that we know all lives matter, but I see black people getting killed? Don't their lives matter? And I think a lot of times, too, and I heard this from, I talked to some of my pastor friends, they said, one of the reasons why white people don't like that phrase because you're leaving them out. Well, we're not leaving you out. You know, it's the aspect we're addressing a situation. We believe in all lives matter. We're not questioning that at all, period. It's the aspect of that, because of that premise, why are we seeing one ethnicity being killed as though it didn't matter? And that's the reason behind that. And I think that a lot of people are getting this now. I think more and more people are getting it. I've seen it on Facebook. People are getting it. Even white people are explaining this now. seriously, they are explaining this and explaining it to their white friends, which I think is great. One of the things that I see now is more unity than I've ever seen before about this. I think that, you know, our young kids, man, who grew up together, they are appalled of what they saw. I'm talking about white, black, Hispanic. They all are. And that's why you see more of a multi-ethnic group of people protesting this, because what they saw was appalling to them. And so those are the types of issues. Nobody ever said that black lives are more important. No, that's not the issue. It's based on what we're seeing.
Gotcha.
That's all.
And I don't think anybody would look at what happened with that police officer and George Floyd and say and conclude, yeah, that was the right thing to do. I think everybody at every level condemns it. And most certainly we do. Let's take a little slightly different direction as our time gets a little thin. One of the things that's going on that you may or may not know is the millennial generation that have been appalled at what they have seen are now accusing moms and dads, their white moms and dads, of being racist. Yeah. So what words of advice would you have for parents with young adult children that are running down this road of mom and dad are racist, all white people are racist, the system is all rigged, and mom and dad who have always taught them to love everyone and to love as Jesus did are now being labeled as racist. What words of advice would you have for this family or these families that are caught up in this moment?
You know, I think that's man, that's kind of horrible to me to even hear that. I think one of the things that they have to do is explain the periods of time in which people grow up in. Because there are different values, there were different times, there were different laws, there were just different types of situations. But yet and still, they didn't hate. Yet and still, they engaged. And I think that the reason why for them to even tell their kids, hey, love everybody, because they didn't. And I think that the kids need to hear the narratives of the past and how they engaged and how they are in relationships with people who don't look like them. I think one of the things is this, is that because they don't see it around them, or people don't talk about it, and it's this assumption. Also, media also educates our kids, all right, and gives a false narrative. And they have to be the ones to really enforce that. I think a lot of kids right now are assuming a lot, and they don't understand a lot because they grew up with the ethnicity. Mom and dad probably didn't, but yet and still they didn't hate. And I think that more dialogue, more honest dialogue between parents and children will help that. And based on the fact that they're teaching it, should share some light on the kids of how their parents are. That's awful for me, for them to go through that, and for them kids to perceive that.
But now in KC, though.
So let me just make real quick commentary. Our time's almost done. There's one question left. Luther made two really good points here. And if your family is in the midst of one of these moments where your kids are accusing you, he made two really good points. He said, number one, our kids don't understand history. Because they don't understand history, they don't have the foundation upon which to think well of this moment that our country is going through. I think that's a significant, really significant point. The second point that he made is the question, do we as parents model for our kids how to seek relationships with people that are different than us? Now, certainly in Hastings, we don't have a lot of opportunity for racial diversity, but there's all kinds of opportunity for economic diversity. Have our kids seen us purposely seek out people that are different, that live differently, think differently, and try to build relationships with them? And to me, that is a very good question and haunting for many of us. Part of that idea is that modeling gives strength to the argument. Have we modeled this for our kids? I think it's a fair question. There's one more question left. Hang on, we'll be done in just a few minutes.
Parents who have lived in Kansas City, there's a lot of opportunity for ethnic diversity.
Yeah.
Rural Nebraska, mom and dad may not have any stories at all about how they've had friendships, relationships with Native Americans, with Jews, with Asians, with blacks, with other ethnicities, because it's very white there.
Mm-hmm.
So if they don't have any stories, all they can do is tell and model loving everyone, but yet they get labeled by their kids as a racist. How do you move forward? Where does the conversation begin?
Let's start with the conversation based on what we see in the narratives in the Bible. We see all kind of racism in the Bible, all right? And what their perception is of that, and how they have explained that to their kids to understand that there are differences with people and how God wants us to deal with that. For their kids to get to that perspective, I believe it's based on what the parents have done. But also, I think that they need to be validated. I think that those parents need to be validated, because one of the things is this: people don't talk about this. Like, especially black people don't talk about this. Without white people, the civil rights movement would never would have took place. Mm-hmm. And then what happened?
True, very true.
Because we have to go through Proverbs 31, verse 8 and 9. And that's one of the things that I put in my explanation. You have to speak and validate the voices for people who are oppressed, because they don't have a voice. And during that period of time, Martin couldn't have a voice unless he had white people who opened up doors for him so he can have that voice. I think that also, too, we want to be able to help those families. And I think that, to validate their voice based on the fact that they never hate it. They can share that they support it in some kind of way, what this situation was, and always are being, because that's kind of hard to try to narrate and to navigate in that type of area when there is diversity there. It's economic,
Absolutely.
You know, but if they're looking at people as God wants to see, then one of the things that I think their kids need to see is for their parents engaging in those different people.
Yeah.
Because what that's going to tell them is that they do care about all people.
I think that's a good point.
Because here in poverty takes all color. Poverty does not discriminate. And so that's why we have a multi-ethnic congregation, because of the people around us. And the only thing you can do is deal with the people that is around you. So there's different people in the community. So diversity does not necessarily mean skin color or nationality. It's economics, it's age, it is positions.
Yeah.
You know, do principals hang around janitors, you know? Because a lot of times people stay in their own status quo, you know, in their own positions. Let's put it like this. Small churches don't really have relationship with large churches. That's discriminatory. I remember when we first planted this church, and I'm going out and I'm talking to megachurch pastors about who we are and what we're doing. And I had one pastor come to me and say, "Why should we allow you to be dependent upon us?" That broke my heart and it upset me, because he thought I want to be dependent upon. I'm not dependent upon you. I'm dependent upon God. And God tells me in the body, in the word, that the body supports itself. And if you're a church and you belong to Christ, you're part of the body. I'm part of the body. And I'm just coming to you to ask the question. You may not be that part that supports me, but you should not communicate that way to me and saying, "Why I want to be dependent upon you." I'm dependent upon God. And so now they look at themselves as though they are better than us. And that within itself is also discriminatory.
Real quick, last question, How would you advise white Americans, and specifically white evangelical Americans, what would you advise us to do to improve race relations? Where does the conversation begin?
First thing, acknowledge that there's a problem. Because if you don't acknowledge there's a problem, there's not going to be a conversation.
Right.
Secondly, one of the things that I don't like for people to do things just because they think they have to. It has to come from the heart. If you truly care about people, engage with people who are different than you. Begin building relationships with people that are not in your category or in your status quo or in your geographical area or your generation. I have friends who are teenagers, and I have friends who are 75 and 80, and they're white, black, green, whatever. And I think that if we begin talking in that way and wanting to learn from one another, I think that's important because it broadens our perspective about God and about one another. I think it has to be an intentional thing because guess what? It's the Great Commandment. Great Commandment says go, therefore, that's intentional. And to make disciples, there's the imperative thing, to make disciples. Of who? That's an inclusive aspect of all nations, right? And so we want to identify them with God. And then we want to instruct. We have to teach. The inspiration comes from God, from Jesus, and Lord, I'll be with you even to the end of the age. Yeah. So if we go by that paradigm, I think that God will bless us. If we love God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love my neighbor as I love myself, because God says in 1 John chapter 4, he says, how in the world can you say you love me and you hate your brother? Yeah. I mean, that's a false narrative. And so in this case, I think if genuine people who are Christians, and I'm just going to leave out the evangelical aspect because that's divisive within itself. If we are truly Christians, brothers and sisters in Christ, we're going to love one another and we're going to build those bridges. And it will be inspired by love and intentional so our kids can be able to see it. Not just the kids, but this is what God has called for us to do. Yeah. I think that's the mandate for us. That's one of the last things that Jesus said. I want to keep that in my mind. So one of the things is, I love Hastings, man. You know, I was telling y'all last night, I just don't go up there to preach or to get honor. I truly love the people. And I want to do whatever God calls me to do to enhance you, your wife, the church, that community. I've gained relationships up there. I've talked to some of the police officers up there. They go. Some of them go to your church, mm-hmm. you know, and they seek me out when I come up there. Yeah. But I embrace them, man, because these are God's people. And though their skin color is like, man, there's commonalities, man. And that's we have to look for the commonalities and quit looking for the differences all the time. I mean, that's what the world does. Right. We have to look at the commonality. Yeah.
Well said. I think the acknowledging that there's a problem, that's got to be the first step. And in the absence of that, everything else is just words.
Yeah.
So very well said. I appreciate that. Thanks so much, Luther, for helping us think through these things. You may love Hastings E-Free Church, but there's a lot of people that love you more, I think. And I think that you can say things to us in ways other people can't because of how much we love you. So thank you for your years of service to the Lord, the way you love our church. We love you right on back, and may the Lord continue to bless your ministry.
Thanks, God. Appreciate it. Y'all got a good pastor.
I paid him to say that just to clarify. One thing that Luther really pressed upon me, Scott, do you believe there's a problem? And, man, I struggle with that a little bit. But he believes it all begins with acknowledging that there is a problem. And certainly our society has progressed since the 60s. We're in a far different place than we were. But if you don't think that a problem exists, can I just ask you one question as your pastor? Have you ever referred to someone in Hastings as white trash? Is that not the same as inferior and superior applied to a group of people? We cannot say that the problem does not exist. As long as the sin nature exists, we're going to have a problem. And we're not going to fix it. Our government's not going to fix it. God will fix it someday in heaven. And the fact that it's never going to be fixed does not absolve us as God's people from seeking to fix, to restore, to model, to show what it looks like to value all people equally. So we want to acknowledge that there is a problem. And we want to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. Now, I know Luther has his own hypnotic way of talking. I hope it was more than entertainment for you. And I hope somewhere along the way in the video, you squirmed a little. You had to wonder, do I believe that? Do I agree with that? And hopefully it's pressed you a little bit. Because what I want here is for Jesus to be renowned in Hastings through our church because of the way we treat and value everyone. That would be a great place and a great reputation to have as a church. I want to pray and we'll be dismissed. Thank you so much for being here. It's a little long today, but really good with Luther. He would love it if you dropped him a note and said thank you. He's not living easy days down there in KC. So if you could drop him a note and say thanks, he'd appreciate it. Let's pray together. Lord, we acknowledge that there is a problem. The main problem, the big problem, is a sin problem, and Jesus has taken care of the sin problem. And what lingers is the nature that we fight with. And Lord, in our culture, we are fighting with it. Help us as a church to walk these days well, to model for those that are watching what it looks like to be a true Jesus follower, where we value all lives, the unborn to the old, of all ethnicities, all races, all economic classes. We value people because, Lord, we know that you value people. Help us as a church to have that as a reputation for your name's sake. I pray in Jesus' name.